Hi there. Good evening. Sorry about me dashing in at the last minute here. I was wasn't particularly planned, but at 20 to 5 I was leaving Aberdeen, so it wasn't really meant to be a round of applause. That's more really just due to my lack of organisational skills, I think, probably more than anything. Anyway, at least we're here and we're ready to go, so good stuff. Right, well, see if I can get my slides in order tonight and not get myself in a bit of a fankle as I did last week. So let's get cracking. Last week we spent some time looking at the historical sources for the life, death and resurrection of Jesus. And last week we spent some time looking at whether Jesus believed he was the Son of God. Tonight we're going to look at evidence for the resurrection. As I mentioned at the end of the last session, without the resurrection, Christianity is meaningless. And later in the session I'll try and explain why it's so important. So the purpose of this evening is to look at the death and resurrection of Jesus and ask the question, is there compelling evidence to support this being an actual historical event? Now, you may or may not know the detail of the death and resurrection of Jesus. I mean, I know there's quite a lot of people here from a church background, so you probably do. But there'll be those that don't. So to quickly summarise, I thought it would be useful to return to the list of events in the life of Jesus from the historian E.P. Sanders' book, The Historical Figure of Jesus. Now, you might remember from the first night that we went through a list of what Sanders referred to as a list of secure facts about the life and death of Jesus. As I explained in the first night, these secure facts, as he calls them, are those that the majority of contemporary historians are agreed upon, based on the documentary, archaeological and circumstantial evidence available today. So, if I could go back through the bullet points on Sanders' list. And these are the last bullet points on the list that we looked at in the first evening. About the year 30, Jesus, went to Jerusalem for Passover. He created a disturbance in the temple area. He had a final meal with his disciples. He was arrested and interrogated by the Jewish authorities, specifically the high priest. And he was executed on the orders of the Roman prefect, Pontius Pilate. Now, in Sanders' book, this list of secure facts doesn't end there. He then goes on to provide what he refers to, quoting directly, a short list of equally secure facts about the aftermath of Jesus' life. Again, these are historical facts that the majority of contemporary historians are agreed actually happened after Jesus' death. These are, his disciples first fled. They saw him, but in what sense is not certain, after his death. As a consequence, they believed he would return to found the kingdom. And they formed a community to await his return and sought to win others to faith in him as God's Messiah. Now, I wonder if any of you find this last list surprising. I know I did when I first read it. I was surprised that the accepted historical view of the aftermath of Jesus' life was so close to what I understood to be the biblical view. So I guess the purpose of the evening is to focus on that second secure fact, well, the second one on the third one up from the bottom. The third one up from the bottom, that is, they saw him, but in what sense is not certain after his death. Contemporary historians, both Christian and non-Christian, are agreed that something happened to convince the disciples that they had seen Jesus after his death. So what did the disciples see and experience after Jesus' death? In the rational 21st century, it's difficult to get our heads around the idea of a man dying and coming back to life again 3 days later. Our medical knowledge, our understanding of biology and physics, our own personal experience all tell us that people just don't come back to life after they die. So I guess we tend to think, well, surely there's some other explanation. Well, this evening we'll look at some of the more common alternative explanations and see how they sit with the evidence we have for what happened. Well, one explanation could be And it's pretty easy to appear to your disciples after your death if you didn't die in the first place. So, was Jesus really executed? Could he have been taken off the cross before he died, then revived later? At first glance, this doesn't look too implausible. We've all heard of people who've been pronounced dead, then to everyone's surprise, revived some hours or days later in a mortuary or hospital. This kind of thing can occasionally happen today. But what about 2,000 years ago when medical knowledge was more primitive? Could the Romans who have executed Jesus made a mistake? Alternatively, was the whole thing faked? Was the crucifixion somehow stage-managed to avoid some form of diversion to allow Jesus to escape? Well, in response, consider the following. Historians and archaeologists can tell us quite a lot about Roman torture and execution techniques. I won't go into the gory details this evening. There are plenty of books and TV programs on this very subject. But what our knowledge of Roman torture and execution tells us is that it was very unlikely that anyone survived a Roman crucifixion. Now, there are examples from other historical sources that this did happen, but it was a very rare occurrence. And even if Jesus could have been taken off the cross before he died, the nails taken out his wrists and feet, he would have been unable to use his hands and he wouldn't have been able to walk. It's very unlikely he would have made a full recovery. Also, he wasn't executed by amateurs. It was Roman soldiers that did the job. They might not have had 21st century medical knowledge, but they knew exactly how to kill someone. That's what they were trained to do. They were professional career killers. Also, he was executed in the orders of the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. One argument goes that perhaps the soldiers had been bribed by persons unknown not to kill Jesus. Instead, they were to stage manage a fake execution. Firstly, this would have been pretty difficult. It was a public execution, as all crucifixions were. That was the whole point, to act as a warning to others not to disturb the Roman order. Secondly, if this had been found out, the soldiers would have disobeyed a direct order from the commander of the Roman ruler in Palestine. A slow and painful death would have been the inevitable result. Also, the historical documents we reviewed in our first evening agree that Jesus was tortured and flogged before he was crucified. So, in short, just suppose he was able to survive the crucifixion. Just suppose there was some plot to get him off the cross. What kind of condition would he have been in? Hardly an impressive sight for the disciples a few days later. Hardly an inspiration for the disciples to go and spread the message of the risen Christ triumphing over death throughout the Eastern Mediterranean and the Roman Empire. So, in summary, it's highly unlikely that Jesus survived his crucifixion. It's also highly unlikely that the whole thing was stage-managed either. However, as you're aware, the faked crucifixion theory has some popular currency at the moment. If you've read the book or seen the film of Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, you'll know that one theory is that Jesus didn't die on the cross. Instead, he escaped to southern France along with his wife, Mary Magdalene. In southern France, their children intermarry with the Merovingians, thus creating a holy bloodline that the Catholic Church has been trying to suppress ever since. This theory is based on an earlier book by Bajant, Lee and Lincoln called The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. It's the book in the far right-hand corner. Now, we could spend some time this evening looking at the pros and cons of this theory. However, this would be going over ground well covered in the numerous books and articles written on this subject currently available. Instead, what I think I can say is that this theory is just that, a theory. Whilst there are historical factual elements to this theory, other facts are ignored. There's also a large amount of speculation required to arrive at the conclusions the book and film make. If this is an area of interest to you, my suggestion would be to read the reviews, books and articles on the subject. A simple Google search will get you going. A review of these items will, I think you'll find, demonstrate why this theory really has no serious takers amongst the overwhelming majority of contemporary historians. So, it would look most likely, that Jesus was executed. But what happened to his dead body? This is important to consider. First, clearly it would be difficult to explain Jesus being alive after his death if his corpse was still in his tomb. The gospel account of what happened to Jesus' body is that he was executed, he was prepared for burial, placed in a rock cave tomb. On the third day after his death, some of his female followers went to the tomb and they found the tomb open and Jesus' body missing. And as we saw on the first evening, although documentary evidence in the gospel seems to vary in some of the details of the empty tomb, the event is present in all four gospels. Clearly, early Christians believed that his body disappeared from earth so that he could come back alive to his followers. However, are there any other explanations why his body might have been missing from the tomb? Well, perhaps the best way of approaching this is to look for a motive. Who could have removed the body from the tomb? And what would their motive be for doing so? Well, the Romans could have. And the Romans' main concern was maintaining order in Jerusalem. Their motivation for executing Jesus, as we've seen from E.P. Sanders' list, was in direct response to the disturbance Jesus had created in the temple area. This disturbance created the unrest the Romans were always seeking to avoid in this very volatile part of their empire. Now, Jesus had some very devoted followers. Perhaps the Romans were concerned that by leaving Jesus' body in his tomb, it would become a shrine to Jesus and a focal point for further unrest. And this line of thought has some modern parallels. For example, at the end of the Second World War, the Russians discovered Hitler's body in his burned-out bunker in Berlin. However, they destroyed the body so it couldn't be buried. Their concern was Hitler's grave would become a focal point for Nazi sympathisers in the future. However, what undermines the theory of the Romans taking the body is that very shortly after Jesus' death, his followers are going around saying that he's risen from the dead. They're making a nuisance of themselves and causing the very disorder the Romans were trying to avoid. Indeed, the Romans then spent the next 350 years trying to suppress the disorder that developed throughout the Roman Empire as a result of this one event. So, to nip all this in the bud, to stop it getting out of hand, if the Romans had taken Jesus' body, would they not have produced it? Now, a common fate for corpses of crucifixion victims, as I touched on in the second evening, was that they were thrown in a municipal rubbish dump and eaten by wild animals and dogs. If this is what had happened to Jesus, the Romans might not have had the body. However, it had been a relatively simple thing to publicly state that this is what had happened to the body. However, we've got no direct evidence or even hints of evidence that this happened. We have to conclude, therefore, that it's unlikely that the Romans were responsible for the empty tomb. Another group that could have taken Jesus' body was the Jewish authorities. However, their motivation for taking his body and the counter-arguments are really the same as the Romans. Disciples are going around creating the disorder a few days after Jesus' death, proclaiming the risen Christ, causing a tremendous amount of disorder in Jerusalem, stirring up the people. Why would they not nip it in the bud if the Jewish authorities had taken the body? So it looks unlikely that both the Romans or the Jewish authorities were responsible for moving the body. What about the disciples? Would they have had a motive for taking Jesus' body from the tomb? This would also look to be unlikely. I personally can't think of a motive they might have for doing this. Also, the disciples believed that Jesus was raised from the dead and were prepared to die for this belief. In fact, in most cases, they did die for this belief. So if they had taken the body, why would they then make up the raised from the dead story and be prepared to die in defense of that story? Just doesn't make any sense. What about grave robbers? Well, to me, the idea of that the grave robber stole Jesus' body looks more of a possibility. Grave robbing did occur at this time. Robbers were looking for the valuable goods sometimes buried with a body. In fewer cases, they were looking for the body or body parts for use in magic rituals. However, was there anything to steal? Well, the Synoptic Gospels mention that Jesus' body was wrapped in a linen cloth. No grave goods are mentioned. Grave robbers usually steal the goods buried with a body, not the decomposing body itself. John's Gospel mentions that about 34 kilograms of myrrh and aloes were wrapped in the linen cloth around Jesus' body. This would have been worth stealing. However, John's Gospel also tells us that Jesus' grave clothes were in the tomb, with the burial cloth neatly folded, when the disciples entered the tomb and found Jesus' body missing. This doesn't fit with the grave-robbing theory. If you were robbing a grave of spices wrapped into the linen bound around a dead body, it would make sense to either take the wrapped body from the tomb to be unwrapped to remove the spices elsewhere, or to unwrap the body in the tomb, take the spices, and leave the body. In the first scenario, there would be no body or grave clothes left in the tomb. In the second scenario, there would have been an unwrapped body and the grave clothes. Also, we know from a few Roman and Greek sources that dead human bodies or body parts were used in magic rituals around the Roman Empire. However, the practice wasn't rife, and we've no evidence that this occurred within this part, the Jewish part of the Roman Empire. Indeed, Jews would have found this kind of behaviour abhorrent. The burial occurred in Jerusalem, the most Jewish of Jewish towns and cities. This makes the concept of a stolen body for the purposes of magic even less likely than if the burial had occurred in, say, Athens or Rome. So, nobody seems to have a particularly strong motive for either taking the body or keeping it a secret if they did take the body. One final point's worth making on this subject. The disciples of Jesus were the founders of what we know as Christianity. After the resurrection, they didn't go to some obscure place miles away from where it had all happened to preach about the resurrection. No, they went back to Jerusalem, the very place of Jesus' execution and tomb. Fundamental to their preaching was the empty tomb of Jesus. If this preaching had been false, it would have been clearly evident to the people of Jerusalem. Some people would have been bound to know where Jesus' tomb was and or what had happened to his body. The population of Jerusalem at this time was about 150,000, about the size of contemporary Dundee, so not a big city. Word would have got round. Clearly, it would be very difficult to win converts if one part of their teaching was so evidently false. So, in conclusion, I suppose we can't say that there's any concrete evidence to demonstrate that Jesus' body left earth, as the disciples claimed. However, what is clearer is that his body disappeared, and that those with a vested interest in claiming that it was still on earth, the Romans and the temple authorities, couldn't prove that it actually was. At the start of the evening, I mentioned the E.P. Sanders' secure fact that Jesus' disciples saw him, but in what sense is not certain, after his death. As we saw, Sanders says this because historians are the majority view that Jesus' disciples saw him after his death. What historians are less certain about is the in what sense part of the statement. So what do the Gospels and letters of Paul say the disciples saw? Well, there was more than one appearance. There's 11 separate and distinct appearance events described in the Bible. These appearances happened to individuals, groups of people, and in one case, 500 people. They happened over a period of 40 days after Jesus' death, with the exception of his appearance to Paul, which happened much later. The Gospels were clear that Jesus was with them physically. He could eat, drink, cook, be touched and conversed with. He could appear and disappear at will. And often in the appearance events, the disciples don't seem to immediately recognize the person they're with as Jesus. As I said earlier this evening, in the rational 21st century, it's difficult to get our heads around the idea of a man dying and coming back to life again 3 days later. Our medical knowledge, our understanding of biology and physics, our own personal experience all tell us that people just don't come back to life after they die. So, are there any other possible explanations for what the disciples saw other than the risen Christ? Well, did they see a ghost Well, for us in the rational 21st century, this is a bit as hard to grasp as seeing the resurrected Jesus. However, the descriptions of a physical Jesus that could eat, drink, and be touched doesn't sound like a spectral appearance. So, unlikely that they saw a ghost. Or were they subject to some form of hysteria? The followers of Jesus would have been very distraught after his death. That can make people a bit irrational and unstable. Is it possible that seeing Jesus alive again was all in their minds? Some form of mass hallucination? Some form of fevered imagination or wish fulfillment? In response to this, our knowledge of psychology tells us that hallucinations are individual occurrences. They aren't something that happens to groups of people at the same time. Also, there are multiple appearances of Jesus over a period of 5 weeks to different people and to the same people more than once to be explained. One could just about imagine a situation where a small group of people grieving in a room together might work themselves up into such an emotional frenzy that they were all able to convince each other that they saw the person they were grieving over. I guess we've all seen footage of people having intense, ecstatic and religious experiences like this. We've been involved in it ourselves, I guess. Induced by a charismatic preacher, their emotional condition, hallucinogenic drugs, or their own ability to go into a self-induced trance. Well, could any of the appearance events fit with something like this? Well, if I'm honest, the circumstances of one or two could. Also, if I'm honest, there is nothing in the gospel accounts hinting that anything like this actually happened. And for the rest, the actual appearance descriptions in the gospel just don't fit with some form of ecstatic event. For example, two disciples are walking to a village called Emmaus in broad daylight. They're chatting when suddenly Jesus appears to them. In another event, the disciples are out catching fish in the Sea of Galilee. As they come ashore, Jesus is waiting for them and has cooked breakfast for them. In another, Jesus appears to 500 people at the same time. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, there are 11 separate appearance events in the documentary evidence that we have. When these are studied and dissected, there is little or no evidence to suggest that hysteria played a part in the appearance events experienced by the disciples. Well, did they just all make it up, though? Another possible explanation. However, as I mentioned before, nearly all the disciples met violent deaths proclaiming Jesus as the risen Son of God. They just wouldn't have done this if they'd made the whole thing up. So, in what sense, to use E.P. Sanders' words, did they see Jesus? Well, it's unlikely they saw a ghost. It's unlikely that they suffered some form of hysterical event. And it's unlikely they made it up. As I've said a few times this evening, in the rational 21st century, it's difficult to get our heads around the idea of a man dying and coming back to life again 3 days later. It's pretty implausible. It just doesn't happen. But historians tell us that the disciples saw Jesus after his death. We've looked at various explanations, alternative explanations for this. And by deduction, it would seem that the least unlikely explanation is that they actually saw Jesus alive after his death. By deduction, the other explanations look even more implausible than this. So, is there any other evidence beyond what we've talked about so far this evening to support the resurrection? What we've looked at so far points to the resurrection being an actual historical event. However, is there any other evidence we should consider? I think the answer is a clear yes. Let's consider the following. Well, the disciples died for their beliefs. We've touched on this a couple of times in the last 5 or 10 minutes. Let's consider this in a bit more detail. Well, so what, you might say. Countless people have died for their beliefs since the disciples. For thousands of years, people have been enthusiastically dying for what they sincerely believe in. From Emily Pankhurst to Bobby Sands to the suicide bombers in Iraq in Israel, in Afghanistan, to the terrorists involved in the London tube bombings, to the Tall Puddle martyrs, to the Jews in the Spanish Inquisition. These are just a few of the countless number of people that have died for their sincerely held beliefs since the disciples. However, there's one key difference with the disciples. The disciples sincerely believed that Jesus had died. And they sincerely believed that they had personally met him after his death. They sincerely believed that they had personally conversed with him, eaten with him, and touched him. And they were prepared to die for this belief. What they weren't prepared to die for was an ideology or a set of beliefs passed on to them from some political or religious leader. They were prepared to die and did die because they had personally seen Jesus alive after his death. Another piece of circumstantial evidence is the conversion of the skeptics. In the very early days of Christianity, two of the early leaders of the Way, as the early Christians called themselves, were people who had been unconvinced that Jesus was the Son of God. In the first evening, we heard about Paul. As Saul, he was a persecutor of Christians, and what changed him was to a follower of Jesus was meeting Jesus alive on the road to Damascus sometime after his death. The other former skeptic, an early leader we know of, is James, the brother of Jesus. Now, Jesus wasn't an only child. He had a number of brothers and sisters. Indeed, his whole family, including his mother, initially tried to stop him in his mission. In Mark's gospel, his whole family, presumably James included, come to get him. Mark says, when his family heard about this, that is his teaching, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he's out of his mind. That was Mark chapter 3, verse 20. Now, James isn't mentioned as a follower of Jesus in the gospel. Yet in the early church, James was a leading figure. Well, why the change? Well, we're told in Paul's letters that he too had seen Jesus after his death. James changed from being a skeptic to a believer after seeing the risen Christ. Another piece of circumstantial evidence is relating to changes in key social structures. And what I mean by that is, if I perhaps explain this a bit more detail, ask yourself the question, why are there Jews today? Jews can trace their origins back to the tribal Middle East of 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. Now, there were other peoples about at that time. Why is it then that there are no people alive today who would call themselves Babylonians, Hittites, Assyrians, Ammonites, and so on? One answer is of the social structures that make Jews Jews. Jewish people have lived side by side with non-Jews for the last 2,000 years, but have remained distinctly different because of their own customs, laws, eating habits, religious beliefs, I guess, as well, and so on. And to Jews, these are the things that make them who they are, and are terribly important to them. Always have been, still are today. Even non-religious Jews, people, Jews that don't believe in God, still classify themselves as Jews. I saw a program recently on that very subject. Now, some people have viewed the early Christians as just another Jewish sect. And in a sense, they were. However, they were different from the other Jewish sects that existed at that time. These other sects didn't disagree with the fundamentals of Judaism. Now, the first Christians were all Jews. And we've got clear evidence that early after Jesus' death, that these Jewish Christians rejected many of the foundations of Judaism, an enormous social leap, and one that brought with it great personal risk to their lives. So what were these changes? Well, they stopped offering animal sacrifice. They eventually rejected the belief in keeping Moses' laws, not the Ten Commandments, but the other eating, social, and sacrifice laws that Jews believed was the way to be right with God. They changed the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. They believed in a Trinity, that is, one God in three forms. This was blasphemy to the Jews. They believed that the Messiah had come. The Jews were and are still waiting. And they initiated the new ritual of the Lord's Supper, a ritual that celebrates Jesus' victory over death. Well, why did the early Jewish Christians make these changes? Because the leaders had seen Jesus alive after his death, remembered his teachings, and were therefore compelled to make these changes. Another piece of circumstantial evidence is the emergence of the Christian church. In the first evening, we talked about how quickly after Jesus' death, Christianity caught hold and spread through the Roman world. Why did this happen? Equally importantly, why did Christianity survive? Particularly when other religious fads we're aware of existed in the Roman Empire, didn't survive. Why didn't Christianity fizzle out after a few decades? Well, the answer is the resurrection. A core of people witnessed Jesus alive after his death. This core of people were transformed from illiterate fishermen, Jewish zealots, tax collectors, and other ordinary people to tireless advocates for the risen Jesus. As we saw earlier in the evening from the E.P. Sanders list, they, the disciples, formed a community to await his return and sought to win others to faith in him as God's Messiah. They did all this because of the resurrection. Without the resurrection, there would have been no lasting Christianity. Without the resurrection, we wouldn't be here talking about it tonight. So, in conclusion, I started this course by making two statements. There's a historical and rational basis for Jesus being the Son of God. And there's a wealth of evidence to support this view. To end, let's review what we've looked at over the last three evenings. Well, firstly, we presented evidence demonstrating that the Gospels and most of the letters of Paul are likely to provide an accurate account of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And we suggest that these documents have been, on the whole, accurately preserved for us and haven't been subjected to accidental or deliberate or significant accidental or deliberate modification. We reviewed other historical information that was contemporary to but out with the Gospels. This provided information that didn't contradict what was in the Gospels and letters of Paul. We presented evidence demonstrating it was very likely that Jesus saw himself as the Son of God. We also suggested it was very unlikely he saw himself in this way due to some form of psychological condition. And we suggested it was very unlikely that Jesus deliberately misled his followers so that they believed he was the Son of God. Tonight, we demonstrated evidence that it was very likely that Jesus was executed and died, and that it was very likely he was buried, and that shortly afterwards his tomb was found to be empty. We looked at possible reasons for his tomb being empty, and we suggested that the least unlikely explanation was that his body was no longer on earth. We looked at the historical basis for Jesus' appearances to his disciples. We found that this is regarded as a secure fact by most historians. And we reviewed what it was that the disciples saw. We suggested that the least unlikely explanation was that the disciples saw, met, talked, and ate with Jesus in bodily form after his death. Lastly, we reviewed some circumstantial evidence for the resurrection. And we suggested that without the resurrection, it's likely that the disciples wouldn't have died for their beliefs. Skeptics like Paul and James wouldn't have been converted. A clear separation of Jewish Christians and Judaism would not have occurred. The early church would not have emerged and spread so quickly. And Christianity wouldn't have lasted to this day. Now, history is rarely an exact discipline. We can rarely say with absolute certainty that something happened in the past at a particular time and that it happened in a particular way with absolute certainty, as I said. Even today, with mass communication, controversy can rage relating to events that happened last week or a few years ago. For example, John F. Kennedy's assassination and Princess Diana's death are good examples of that. And it's the same with Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. I can't say with absolute certainty that the evidence I've presented is 100% correct. I can't say that with absolute certainty that Jesus is the Son of God. But I think what I can say is that Jesus being the Son of God is the most likely explanation for the pretty extensive evidence that we have. What I can say is that looked at rationally, the alternative explanations for the evidence are simply far less likely. Now, I'm sure some of you will be agreeing with this. I'm also sure some of you will be thinking, well, isn't this a bit one-sided? Christian presents evidence for Christianity in church setting. Surely there's another point of view. Frankly, if I'd been sitting where you are when I was an agnostic, I'd be thinking exactly like this. In fact, I did think like this. However, my spiritual journey didn't end by reading The Case for Christ, the book I mentioned in the first evening. After this, I trawled bookshops for books on atheism. I felt sure that I'd find some atheistic stuff that would blow all this out of the water. I scoured atheist websites. I read detailed and hostile reviews of The Case for Christ. I listened to and read books and articles by atheists. I still do. I read the New Testament for myself. I read biographies and critiques of Jesus by non-Christians. And I'd encourage anyone with doubts about the material presented over the last 3 evenings to do exactly the same. And what was the result of all this research? Well, I think I can summarize this by saying that I was an agnostic then, and I'm a Christian now. It's all very interesting, but is this of any importance to you and to me today? What we haven't discussed in these sessions is Jesus' message and what it means. And what we haven't discussed is why Jesus' message is important to you and to me today. You may or may not be glad to know that we're not going to start now. However, consider this. If Jesus is the Son of God, if Jesus is real, then his message is real too. In the last 2,000 years, countless lives have been positively transformed by Jesus' message. And don't kid yourselves. If you truly accept Jesus' message, and I'm stressing the words truly accept and Jesus' message, it's always a positive transformation. So, in conclusion, do you not owe it to yourselves to weigh up the evidence yourself and decide what you think? And if you do this and decide that Jesus is real, do you not owe it to yourselves to find out what his message is and start to experience that positive transformation? Thank you very much.